Collier for Thomas Matters Radio. Recording today on October the 28th. Today is a Friday. Sponsor today, Omega Processing Solutions. 2015 marked the ninth straight year that gift cards were the most requested gift item. Are you missing out on those sales opportunities by not having an established gift card program? Well, let me give you a updated countdown here until Black Friday. 27 days and actually 11 hours, 13 minutes, and 2 seconds to go to Black Friday to be exact. So if you're a small business and you want some help taking gift cards and coming up with a customized gift card and loyalty program built directly for your business, you should call Omega Processing Solutions. Omega Processing's easy-to-use gift card and rewards program can help make your holiday shopping season brighter. Contact them. Customer service, 866-888-9724, 866-888-9724, extension 7, and they'll give you more information on getting your program up and rolling before the holiday crunch begins, and that is right now, 27 days. So today on the show, we've got Ben Liebing. Ben came in hot with a hot take. I guess it's been 2 days now. He published an article on Medium, which really kind of demonstrated the downfall to the Cincinnati Inquirer. The title of the article is called The Slow Death of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Ben was a reporter there from, I think, for 5 months or so. So he was there a pretty short time. But he covered downtown over the Rhine for the Inquirer. Parent company is Gannett. And just kind of detailed, I think it was really interesting. We know the Inquirer is not doing well. They're laying people off almost yearly now. That's not a secret. And then a couple of days ago, Politico reported, quote, Gannett, the largest U.S. newspaper company, is cutting another 2% of its workforce. That's across the United States. That cut will total around 350 or more positions throughout the company. And that was made official in an internal memo to Gannett employees by CEO Bob Dickey. Gannett also announced its third quarter earnings on Thursday. Company insiders say that it won't be pretty, as print avenues revenue losses largely between 5 and 8% at many of more than its 100 properties swamp efforts at digital business revenue growth. So Ben came out and he said basically why. And I'm not going to talk too much about it right now, so we're going to call Ben right now on the For Thomas Matters Radio podcast phone line and see what he has to say. So on the For Thomas Matters Radio podcast call-in line, we now have Ben Liebing. Ben wrote the article that we talked about in the introduction, The Slow Death of the Cincinnati Inquirer, on Medium. Was that yesterday or 2 days ago, Ben?
That was yesterday.
Yesterday. So Ben is now the communications director at Eat Tank. Eat Tank is, let me know if I'm getting this wrong, I'm taking this directly from your website. It's a community obsessed with teaching humans how to navigate our complex modern food world. Is that it in a nutshell?
That's it in a nutshell. It's really a team that's a few doctors and myself that's helping people understand how to read their food labels and eat properly without, you know, having to become a PhD in health science. So.
Well, Ben, actually, he was smart. He got out of journalism, unlike myself, and figured out that the PR world is where we make our money. Gannett, hopefully, if it gets back on its feet, Gannett, you know, For Thomas Matters is for sale, and you can buy me so that I can go out into the PR world like Ben and actually make some money.
There you go. There you go.
So, Ben, let's get into the article. You published it on Medium, and if you're not familiar with Medium, if the listeners are not familiar with it, it's basically a daily news feed. It's sort of reimagined, and it's straight from the people who, you know, are making and living the news. So, You know, you don't have to have a website necessarily to publish good content. If good content is readable and people like it, it'll move up those ranks. Is that a good way to characterize Medium, Ben?
Yeah, that's a great way. You know, I found out about it several years ago when they were starting out, and I didn't know how seriously to take it. I actually had an official blog at the time, and I thought, well, what's this? And I saw actually John Krakauer, mm-hmm. who is a famous author, wrote books like In the Thin Air. He posted a great article on Medium. I thought, well, people like him are using it. Anybody can use it. You know, any serious journalist or any, you know, blogger can use it to get the word out. So yeah, it's a great tool, and it's exactly what it says. It's a medium.
And I think I can't remember exactly who created it, but I think Medium was it created by somebody that was high up into Twitter too? I can't remember exactly who it was, but I remember hearing about it myself on a podcast that it was probably like either Nerdist or, oh, I don't know, Freakonomics, yeah. Something like that. And I heard about it. And I think it's going to be the next big thing. And maybe that plays directly into kind of the thesis of your, you know, general main theme of the article, which I thought was one of the best articles I had read in a long time. The Slow Death of the Cincinnati Enquirer. So I'm gonna read a few snippets of it and then let you kind of explain it in your own words. I'll start out with your second paragraph here. The Cincinnati Enquirer may be on its last death kicks. Yesterday, we're talking Wednesday, was a dark one for the paper as Gannett, its parent company, announced wide layoffs. And while it saddens me that people should lose their jobs or that a once great newspaper should ever be reduced to the likes of USA Today, perhaps it's worth asking the question journalists are supposed to start with, : why? So, Ben, let's start right there. Why?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think when you look at people losing jobs in any market, you know, journalism is the one we're specifically dealing with, you know, because that's what we've got experience in. But, you know, I heard, I don't know if you're familiar with Adam Carolla, who also has a great podcast.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he talks about the economy and jobs a lot. And he has a line that I've always really appreciated that where he says, you know, I don't see people who are really great at what they do. I never see them without a job. And so he said, if you're, you know, the best carpenter, if you're the best plumber, if you're the best journalist, or even among the best, you're always going to be able to find work. That's his theory, right? So when you apply that to something like the Enquirer, what it means to me is that, you know, and I think I talked about later in the article how my former colleague Amber Hunt tweeted out kind of a plea that, hey, please read the Enquirer, please subscribe. And I pointed out that, you know, as an example, Vice Media, who's worth $2 billion, I think more than that right now, they never have to beg for clicks. You know, they never clickbait. You know, so it's that theory that if you're good enough and if you're producing a quality enough product, whether that's a house or a newspaper, people will read it, people will buy it, you know, it will create value, right?
So one, and to go back, and one of the main reasons that you say, at least the leadership at Gannett and the Enquirer in particular are having some difficulties right now, is that you, and I'm going to use your words here, Gannett got stuck straddling the two often competing worlds of journalism, the old print and the new digital. And I thought one of the probably some of the most interesting pieces of your article on Medium, if I were to highlight some of them, it would be, you know, the brass meetings that you describe being in, where, you know, they're using words like content is king, but at the same time you have a running tabulation of writers and how well they're doing in terms of digital clicks. I thought that was really, really interesting. Talk more about that.
Yeah, well, the thought really behind them, the what I saw going on at the Enquirer was this kind of race to become or to stay cool. And when what I mean by that is really, really trying, you know, to please readers while at the same time almost trying to tell readers what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned that meeting, you know, we talked about race in Cincinnati, and myself and a few other writers just sounded a laughable, and I thought, you know, this is the Enquirer, and we're talking about, you know, we need to fill quotas, we need more color in the newsroom, we need this or that. And what it all amounted to is that the Enquirer, and I think many media outlets say, are trying to do this thing where they're, instead of sticking with the voice that they had, or, you know, developing a good voice, they're trying to find what people want and then fit that, while at the same time, you know, trying to inform people, you know, per the worldview of the journalists who are writing the news. So it's this really weird conundrum that I think especially the journalists in the newsroom get stuck in, of, hey, we want to be cool, we want to be relevant, we want to write stuff, you know, that people are going to click on. But at the same time, we want to be journalists and we want to, you know, tell the truth and give our point of view. And I think that just gets to be kind of a sticky mess. And I just noticed at the Enquirer that it was a classic example of a newsroom and a paper that really wasn't cool anymore, if I can use that word, or wasn't relevant anymore, really trying too hard to be, if that makes sense.
So obviously you were on, I guess, what would be termed a cool beat. You know, you're covering over the Rhine, downtown, where, you know, a lot of this renaissance of cool, you know, happened or is happening. Talk about, I mean, how did they look up to you in a certain sense to say, all right, you know, he's a millennial. He's part of that demographic that we want. This is who we want to please. This is a cool beat. I mean, were they looking to you to try to drive some of that? Or, I guess, talk about that.
Yeah, sure. They definitely were. It really was. I was lucky to, you know, to get the job and have it for the time I did. It was a cool beat. It was a really coveted beat at the paper. There was a lot of pressure there associated with it, but not too much. It wasn't, you know, for everything I said in the article, the Enquirer, they were never slave drivers. You know, it wasn't like, you know, we had to work 80 hours a week pumping out content. It was not like that. It was a fun job in a lot of ways. There was a move in the newsroom right before I came. Anybody who's tracked at the paper is probably familiar how they, you know, made a lot of staff cuts. Carolyn Washburn, the former editor-in-chief, came in, and there was a big slashes that kind of came down from Gannett through her, I believe. So by the time I walked into the newsroom, I referenced it in the article, but most of the people who I had previously been reading write the paper were gone. Yep. So it was a brand new newsroom, a lot of young folks like myself, you know, mid-20s. And so they were trying to go for that voice. The problem was there was a lack of knowledge of Cincinnati, a lack of experience, and then a general, I think, lack of resources. You know, we weren't getting edited properly, weren't given time to develop articles. There were a lot of articles that I wanted to write, or the colleagues of mine would want to write, where we would want to dive a little deeper into a topic, and there just is not time to do that, you know, at least not in the Enquirer's world. And that was a tragedy in my mind, because there's a lot of investigative journalism that just doesn't get done anymore.
Well, and there was one article that you talked about that you wanted to write about Buddy Gray. Talk about Buddy Gray quickly, who he was and why, you know, you felt, at least in the article, it sounds like you felt like you were told, you know, you're not going in this direction.
Yeah, Buddy Gray, you know, I laid it out in the article, he was a really interesting character in Over the Rhine in the 70s and 80s, and he, many people think, was the person responsible for the decline of Over the Rhine during that time. He was a big proponent of low-income and affordable housing, and he founded the drop-in center, which is still up in Over the Rhine today. Of course, what a lot of people didn't realize, many people at the time championed him as a leader and, you know, a mover and shaker for the poor. Businessmen, of course, I mentioned that term. They called him a poverty pimp, so there was this competing view that Buddy was really hurting Over the Rhine more than helping, and then other people thought, you know, well, he was helping the poor. Turns out, you know, in the long run, a lot of the buildings he got approved through demonstrations against city council and against development a lot of the neighborhoods and buildings he sectioned for low-income housing eventually, of course, fell into ruin because, you know, with low-income housing, generally I just referenced the folks who live in low-income housing generally don't, you know, contribute to the welfare of the buildings or you know, arguably the neighborhoods. And so what you saw happen was a lot of the historic buildings in Overland Line, which were going to be preserved, fell into the hands of, you know, Section 8 low-income housing and then deteriorated from there until, you know, basically the last 5-10 years when the plans were put in place and 3CDC's come in to redevelop, so.
And you mentioned that 3CDC is looked at in a negative light at the Enquirer, and that generally this is your prevailing thought over those two themes, is that and this is your quote here in the article, at the Enquirer, poor people were good, affordable housing initiatives were supposed to be praised, development groups were suspect. Journalists as a whole tend to believe anything that makes money is evil. And then you kind of dropped a little bomb here. This is probably because newspapers notoriously make none. So when you wanted to write about Buddy Gray and the way that you wanted to do it, what were you told?
Yeah, that was a little snark on my part about newspapers making none.
Which is true.
Yeah, it can be true. You know, the ethic at the Enquirer was, I was never told, I don't think anybody was ever told that, hey, go talk nicely about this, you know, poverty initiative and go smear 3CDC. It was never explicit. It was very understated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was never that my editor came to me and said, hey, go dig up dirt on Steve Lieber, you know, or go dig up dirt on city councilor Bob Kessling or whatever. It was more of an underlying ethic of how they allocated their resources. So story ideas, as they went up the chain, generally, if, you know, the one with Buddy Gray, and I had another one talking about affordable housing and how it's not what a lot of people think it is. So, you know, my thesis was affordable housing is actually potentially more harm than good, you know, and I was going to look into that. Ideas like that were shot down. At worst and at best, they were just kind of shoved at the back of the heap and not given resources. So, you know, you had a hard time getting photographers to jump in on your piece if it wasn't something that, you know, they wanted to do. If it didn't fit, again, I talked about that general narrative at the Enquirer. If something didn't really fit with that general narrative, especially in Over the Rhine, you know, the buzzwords at the time were, you know, affordable housing, diversity, race. If something didn't fit into the kind of narrative that I guess I would say the editorial staff at the Enquirer was running with, mm-hmm. it just didn't get done. You know, it got either pushed to the back or told no in some cases.
So it's been 2 days now that this article has been simmering. I've seen it get shared a bunch. I'm going to read again from your article. There are still good journalists at the Enquirer, true ones, solid craftsmen of the ink, but the bad apples from top to bottom far outweigh the good. So now that this article has been out there, you've hit publish. They've obviously read it at this point. Have your former colleagues had any feedback for you on this?
Yeah, they, you know, not all of them like it, of course. You know, it's a little bit of a shot at, you know, the company they still work for. There's actually been mostly good feedback. You know, people just resharing and say, hey, it's about time somebody said this. The old colleagues, you know, at best, they've just said, hey, you know, I'd rather, you know, one guy, I think it was Rob Strickley, said, hey, I'd rather do my laundry than read this. You know, and that's fair. You know, it's not a pleasant thing for him to read, probably. But no, there haven't been any big backlash. Nobody's called me out, said, hey, how dare you? It's mostly been, you know, I think a few of them would have probably preferred that I didn't rub salt in the wound,
mm-hmm.
as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I debated, you know, hitting publish. I knew it was going to be a little bit, it was going to seem potentially mean-spirited, and I didn't want it to come across that way. I had most of this written, actually, about 6 months ago, when I had a number of folks ask me to kind of do this. They said, hey, you know, we think it'd be good for Cincinnati as a whole, if you just put something out there, like, you need to tell people what's really going on there, just, you know, give a little peek inside, you know, because so many people have been disgruntled with the Enquirer, I think, across the city. So I hesitated on whether to publish, and then when I finally did, yeah, not all the old colleagues liked it. John Faraday, yeah. Who was a great writer, no longer currently with the Enquirer, but just a great, great storyteller and good dude. And a really balanced guy and journalist as far as I'm concerned. He read it, and I think he had the best response of everybody. He said, hey, read your article. Really well written. Some of it I agreed with, some of it I didn't. And that was it. I think that was a, you know, great, fair response, you know, from a former writer. So
what do you think did he tell you what he did not agree with? What, I guess?
No, he didn't specifically.
Well, and I guess here's the, you know, here's the cynical part of me. And I probably agree with 95% of what you said. I mean, and that's saying a lot. You can't get anybody to agree 95% on anything.
Yeah, that's quite nice. Yeah.
But so let me play the devil's advocate here. If you wrote it 6 months ago, what was the supposition? What was the reason why you hit publish 2 days ago?
Yeah, the reason was because the Enquirer had made news again, and I thought, well, you know, with the headlines going around, I know this is probably going to hurt the paper. Mm-hmm. And I actually think I thought that was a good thing. You know, it's sad, but I think I've come to the point where I genuinely think Cincinnati would be better off without the Enquirer. So which is a big thing to say, and I don't take that lightly. But you know, at the end of the article, I mentioned some other, you know, news outlets, and I think, you know, every city needs good journalism. Every city needs, you know, great publications, and, you know, to keep businesses and politicians honest. But from what I saw, you know, the short time I was at the Enquirer, and just what many readers have seen over the past year, even, it just seems to me that the Enquirer doesn't represent very well the spirit of the city in any way. And so I thought, you know, if people need to know this, and if the Enquirer's in the news now, this will probably get read by more people, you know, since it's kind of buzzing at the time or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a gut shot in a way. And I just decided that it needed to be said. So,
well, and one of the, so you praise Vice, you praise the Business Courier. And in one of those Business Courier articles, Chris Wetterich in 2014, I think this is probably the layoffs that you were talking about that happened right before you were hired in 2015. He wrote at that time that Carolyn Washburn, who is now no longer with the Enquirer, she said that major changes would be coming to the Enquirer, and that the paper tried to devote fewer resources towards the production of its print and more towards its expanding digital ones. There was a reorganization, and a lot of veteran employees ended up telling Wetterich at that time that they were heading for the door because they would rather take the buyout package than go through another round of upheaval and indignity of reapplying for jobs at the company they've worked at for decades. So I think that's probably like the genesis of, you know, where Ben Liebing comes into the equation. So a lot of these veteran employees that have been around Cincinnati for a long time basically just had enough and they quit.
Right.
And so then Here comes this wave of, you know, millennials, and that's not a disparaging term because I put myself in that category as well. They come in, a lot of them not from here. I think some of the analogies that you used were that, you know, they'd never stepped foot in the West Side. They couldn't pick out Pete Rose or something to that effect. So I guess talk about being in that wave of new journalists, and talk about what it was like, obviously, in that transition period.
Yeah, it was a really interesting time. There was a lot of just general uneasiness, you know, at the paper. It really caught me off guard when I went in. There was just a general tenor of fear, which I think is never a good way to operate a newsroom, you know, but people were afraid to say the wrong thing. You know, people understood that layoffs were happening, you know, recently and ongoing. You know, two of what I would have said were the best writers when I was there were unceremoniously fired during my time, and then, you know, other people were quitting, you know, heading for the door, even when I was there. So it was just, the exodus was ongoing, and it was really a sad newsroom, just kind of a sad and very timid newsroom. On the other hand, a lot of the folks were young and energetic and very smart and fun to work with. Like, we really did have a really fun team over on my side. The problem was, like I said, a lot of them just didn't know Cincinnati. There was just, yeah, simple things that the people, little colloquialisms that my colleagues would go, well, what's that? You know, what was the big red machine? What's the cut in the hill? Yeah. You know, this kind of stuff. And I just think that general lack of a basic understanding of Cincinnati really hurt the writing in a subliminal but important way. And then I think I talked about, too, the shame was that the Enquirer had an amazing resource of archives and, you know, photos. And you could really, you know, you could go back to the Enquirer library and really learn a lot, really, really immerse yourself in the paper in the city. But the sad thing was there just wasn't time for that. So, again, we were so busy churning out content to generate clicks, to generate revenue, right, that the young writers who I think otherwise would have just didn't have the chance or the opportunity to really get to know the city, you know, in which they were writing at all. So I think that was really the shame. You know, I think there's a lot of the writers weren't so much to blame, you know, as maybe the higher ups were, just not giving the time or resources to really do quality work.
So Ben Liebing again, now with Food Tank, is that right? Eat Tank, sorry about that. Digital strategist there, digital communications director there, now saying that, you know, Cincinnati may be better off without the Enquirer. Obviously, that's not going to happen. They're going to stick around and put up a fight as long as they can possibly do so. Some of the things that you're talking about, digital versus print, and the dichotomy of both of those two things. You're talking about, you know, clickbait. You're talking about pop-ups, which, you know, if you're reading an article on the Enquirer anymore, you got to get through quizzes and all that kind of stuff to unlock premium content. Ben, if you're giving them advice now as a former colleague, and you were there for about 5 months, but if you're giving them advice right now, what do you tell them? How do you tell them to fix, you know, what your perceived issues are, or their perceived issues are?
Sure. I would say, stop with the quizzes, stop blocking the content that I want to read. That's number one. You know, I think there's a lot of great stuff on the Enquirer that you just don't get to read because they stop you halfway through, or you know, you run out of free articles to read before they make you subscribe. But in seriousness, I tell them to write the truth, to get to know Cincinnati a little better, to let their writers dive in to material and the history, and then write with a little more depth. Have fun with it, and I think stop trying so hard to please everybody and to get that cool factor. I think if the Enquirer developed a good voice by letting their writers, you know, get into the city and understand it and really love it and work with it, I think they wouldn't have to worry about, you know, online quizzes to generate revenue. I think the readers would come. Not sure if they'll come back, but yeah, I think that's what they could do.
Well, Ben Liebing, thanks so much for being on the show. How can people connect with you, Ben?
Oh, the most easiest is probably Twitter. I'm at Ben Ventures there. It's like Adventures, but B-E-N Ventures. So feel free to give me a shout and read the article. Feedback is welcome.
Well, we'll have it linked on ForThomasMatters.com. It's currently on our Twitter account right now, at Ben Ventures. Ben Liebing, once again, from Eat Tank, the communications director there. Thank you so much for being on the show.
All right, Mark. Really appreciate you having me on. Thanks a lot.
Really good stuff from Ben Liebing on his article, which is entitled The Slow Death of the Cincinnati Enquirer. You can find that on medium.com, not small, not large, medium.com. Also, again, you can find that on our Twitter page. We retweeted that at FT Thomas Matters, for Thomas Matters. So for Ben Liebing, once again, sponsor today, Omega Processing Solutions. If you're a small business and you need some gift cards, get it done and get it done right now. There's only 27 days to Black Friday. I cannot believe how fast 2016 has gone through. Omega Processing's easy-to-use gift card and rewards programs can help make your holiday season brighter. Contact their customer service team, 866-888-9724, 866-888-9724, extension 7. They are the ones that make Fort Thomas Matters radio podcast possible. So thank you to Omega Processing. Thank you once again to Ben Liebing. This is Mark Collier, Fort Thomas Matters Radio.